Good afternoon. So last time we talked about out of order execution, I started talking about loop unrolling in this section, and also about the difference between cache blocking and loop unrolling, that, you know, if you're adding iterations where you change, adding operations to a loop where you change the order in which you access memory, you're probably doing cache blocking, which is a great thing to do, but you should know you're doing cache blocking and like that you're changing the order in which you access memory is why the compiler doesn't do that for you, typically. Talked about out-of-order execution. So we had instruction queues, and the idea is that they had this list of available instructions, and a processor with one of these instruction queues would have a bunch of places where they could execute instructions, like maybe a couple copies of an ALU, and also the data cache and so on, and it would send instructions from this queue into those execution units whenever their operands were ready. And that determined how things got executed. And this meant we could take advantage of knowing this in order to order our operations to lower the number of data dependencies so there were more things that would be ready at a time, so we could use all the ALUs or other execution units the processor had. And so one way of doing this was reassociation. We just changed the order of operations a little bit, taking advantage of things like multiplications commutative and associative. And this exposed more parallelism and got things to run faster because we got to use the execution units more. We always put something in our multiplier rather than having to wait one after the other. And we applied the same concept to loops by using multiple accumulators, which effectively is the same thing but for an entire loop, where we have to do some extra work at the end, but during the loop we had more parallelism, and so the program went a lot faster. And you hopefully did a little of that during lab yesterday. I also sort of obliquely mentioned that we had this idea of shifting bottlenecks, which I'd like to emphasize a little more. That, for example, when we talked about our example for loop unrolling, we got to this bottleneck where unrolling the loop more didn't help. Then we realized that the problem there was that we had extra ALUs, but we weren't using them, so we added multiple accumulators to fix that. And after we did that, now the loop overhead was a bottleneck again, and improving it would help. And this is something that will occur a lot when you're optimizing, that you'll fix one thing up to the point and get to the limit how much you can improve it, then something else needs to be fixed, you fix that, and then you get to a point where maybe that first thing matters again. And this also occurs with, for example, cache optimization. So like if our loop arithmetic is really slow, then it doesn't really, might not really matter that we're having lots of cache misses, because those cache misses happen in parallel with our slow arithmetic. If we make our arithmetic faster, maybe it starts mattering. And it could also occur the other way around. And on the issue of loop unrolling versus cache blocking, I'd like to talk about sort of a pattern you'll see a lot with when you combine loop unrolling and cache blocking, and then you say, I want to get rid of aliasing problems. So I want to put all the values I'm accessing into registers. And this is a common thing we end up doing in things that look like matrix multiply or other matrix operations. We do what's sometimes known as register blocking. So cache blocking, we choose a block we want to put in the cache. Here we're choosing a block of stuff we want to put in registers, and I'm doing that by just declaring local variables in this case. But this is a common pattern. And the same general idea as cache blocking applies. We want as much stuff in registers, but if we have too much, we're going to spill, and it's actually going to use the stack, and it's going to be way slower. Okay. So any questions about what we covered last time? Okay. So I'm going to move on to a different way of doing multiple things at once. So we saw doing multiple things at once because we had multiple ALUs which could perform different instructions in parallel. And so when you saw our multiple accumulator loop, it ended up that we were doing like four instructions every cycle. Nice and really efficient. There's another way we can do multiple operations at once. And this is with something known as vector instructions. So modern processors have these special registers, which rather than just holding one value, hold a vector or a little array of values, a fixed-sized array. So for example, if you buy a current x86 64 processor, it probably has 256-bit registers and maybe 512-bit ones. So a 256-bit register, you could store 8 ints, 8 floats, 4 doubles in there, and you can just have all that in a register. So these are named YMM0 through YMM15. And there are instructions which treat this as an array of values and act on all the values at once. So one instruction operates on 8 ints all at once. Actually, two pairs of 8 ints because you take at least two registers as input, acts on all of them at once. And they perform the same operation on all of those values. So this is called single instruction multiple data, or SIMD. So you have one instruction that's doing the same thing on multiple pieces of data that are in this little array in a register. And generally, one of the reasons these are fast is that there's going to be extra copies of the ALU that are accessed by these vector instructions. So the processors with these 256-bit registers typically have not just an ALU which can do, a set of ALUs which can do 8, for example, integer adds in parallel. And they might in fact have like 4 of those. So they can do 32 integer adds per cycle to accommodate these vector registers and these vector instructions. And the sizes of these vectors has grown over time, so you might also occasionally see or use 128-bit versions of these, which have, instead of Y, they have X. And if you want to guess the name of the 512-bit versions, you'd guess correctly. Yes, it starts with a Z. So let's give an example of one of these vector instructions. So the 256-bit versions are a bit weird compared to other x86 instructions in that they're usually 3 operand instead of 2 operand. So here we have an add instruction, which is doing YM0 plus YMM1 into YMM2. And it adds each pair of values. So suppose we have, and this is a, so this instruction ends with D, which stands for D word, for double word, which is a 32-bit value because x86 named the lengths of types back when it was a 16-bit processor. So double word is twice 16 bits, and that's what this instruction deals with. So it says that the register, as we interpret it, is 8 ints. Let's say we have YMM0, we contain the array 1, 2, 3, 4, up to 8. YMM2 contains 9 up to 16. Then what we're going to do with this instruction is we're going to take each pair. So we're going to take 1 and 9, add them together to get 10, take 2 and 10, add them together to get 12, take 3 and 11, add them together to take 14, and so on. And that's how we're going to form a result. So we just add each pair in this case. And most of the vector instructions work in this way. They take pairs of values from each of the arrays and do the operation on each pair. So this is really parallel in the hardware. We're just doing 8 completely independent additions in parallel. Yes?
Why is it that with vector instructions it puts the results in the third vector rather than just the second?
So why does it put it in the third instead of the second? So the 128-bit versions of the instructions didn't do that. And they added this feature, I believe, because this allows compilers to generate code which does less moves. And they felt that was worth the extra instruction in coding space.
And could you also just do YMM0, YMM1, YMM1? the question is, could we do, yeah, like ymm0, ymm1, ymm1? Absolutely. And you will commonly see that sort of code generated by the compiler. I just wanted to make it clear what was involved. Okay. So, for example, here's a loop and code the compiler might generate. It's not actually the code the compiler generates. I've made it a little simpler. So what we do here is this is a loop where we have 512 values. Which are integers, and we're using that add pairs of integers in this array of ray register. So we have a load instruction here, two load instructions, which load from a particular address, but they load 256 bits. So they load 8 values all at once in this case, because our values are ints. And that means, since this is RAX here is the offset in the array in bytes, that every iteration of the loop we add not 4, the size of an int, but 32, the size of the 4 times the 8 ints we're handling in each of these vectors. And similarly, we have a move instruction to take our result and move it back into A in this case. Yes.
What is V0 upper?
So V0 upper, I have it marked as for calling convention reasons. So V0 upper is an instruction which zeroes out the upper 128 bits of all the YMM registers. And the calling convention says that you're supposed to do that when you return from a function, basically. For not very good historical reasons, but you will see that in generated code, so I put it there. So what you might, this looks like is we have our array B and our array A, and we're loading these segments of 8 elements from each of these into our two registers. We're adding them together and putting the result in one of those registers again. We just have each pair be added together. And I reversed the order on this picture somehow. Probably should be in the not reversed order. So this makes sense what this code does. They just add each pair as we load it in these arrays. And so this allows us to use a lot less instructions to run this code. And generally, the way that ALUs are built for this is that typically we will have just a vector ALU, which is just a whole bunch of ALUs glued together, essentially. And we have what we call separate lanes for the different parts. And we can input the whole vector into this, get out the results, or two vectors into each part, get out the results, and these all work in parallel. And the idea is that that's why these are really efficient. So you might say, well, this seems like I'm adding a whole lot of extra stuff to my processor. And yeah, we are. If we want to have, instead of having ALUs that work on 64 bits at a time, that work on 256 bits at a time, it seems like we're essentially making our ALUs like 4 times bigger in order to have them be this vector ALU thing. That is a real cost. But it's not actually as much of a cost as you might think as far as processor design is concerned. Because your thought is we're making our processor basically almost 4 times as expensive to build just to support these instructions we usually aren't using. But that's not really the case. Because if you remember, we have all this logic that's not dedicated to actually computing things. We have the instruction queue, the reorder buffer, the instruction fetch, all the branch prediction stuff. And that takes up a lot of space in our processor. and all that. That's a lot of control logic, and that turns out to be a lot of what a modern processor is all this control logic. But adding vector instructions, we don't have to change the control logic. It's the same as for if we were just dealing with normal 64-bit numbers. The do I have to wait for a data dependency checking is the same. I'm just different register names, but the logic is exactly the same as if it were normal 64-bit registers as far as dependencies, when can I run instructions, and so on. So it's not actually any extra control logic, basically, but it's a way we can add a lot of computational capacity to our processor. And this is increasingly important because we still are able to increase the number of transistors we can have, and this is a way we can use those transistors effectively. So, questions about this implementation idea? Yeah. So the question is, does this improve cache performance? So a notable thing about what we saw here is that I'm loading 8 values at once. So I'm loading 256 bits. So I'm accessing the cache less often to get the same amount of data. So it improves things in that sense, that we can build our cache to support a 32-byte load instead of an 8-byte load, and that's not much extra logic in the cache, and that is going to give us more efficiency. So in that sense, it does. So other questions? Okay, so showed you vector instructions, and a good question to have is, like, we told you that compilers are good at some things. Well, are vector instructions one of the things the compilers are good at? And the answer is sometimes. They sometimes figure out how to use these, and they've gotten a lot better over the last decade or so. It used to be that they were, like, totally horrible. Like, basically, they would only do it if your code perfectly matched the pattern that was in some benchmark, and maybe not even that. But they're still easily messed up, and there's some good reasons for this. Aliasing is a real problem for using these vector instructions, because if we think of this code here, what if A and B overlap? Then we can't do 8 at a time, because then we're writing out of order, and we won't be writing values that are changing. The case is, like, if, let's say A is in the middle of B, then we expect to be writing values that we're going to read in the later iterations of the loop. If the compiler has to worry about that, it can't do this 8 at a time thing, just like it can't, because it's reordering the loads, just like it can't do cache blocking in that type of case. So aliasing is a problem. In this case, I got the compiler to generate the correct code by using this special keyword restrict, which this is one of the few cases I've seen it ever do anything. It tells the compiler, hey, there's no aliasing here. Please don't try to account for it. So aliasing is a problem. The compiler could, and sometimes does, generate checks to see if things overlap, because these vector instructions are so helpful, but obviously that also means that that's a code size trade-off, right? If you want to generate this vector instruction using code, but only use it if there's no overlap, then you have to generate the extra check for the overlap, which takes time to run, and now you have two versions of the loop, the vector version and the version just in case the two arrays overlap. So that's not, it's not an easy thing to deal with. Another example of something which makes it hard for the compilers to deal with it is, let's say there are conditionals in your loop. That's hard to do with vector instructions, because we saw that add instruction, it's all the same operation. If you're conditionally, like, adding and sometimes subtracting, there's a way of using vector instructions for that, but it's not so easy for the compiler to write or you to write, because you have to change what you do. You aren't doing the same thing to every pair of values, which is what the instructions we have do. And there's also the issue that some operations just don't have a vector instruction. So Intel and other compiler manufacturers provide lots of these vector instructions, but not for everything. So for example, Intel does not provide a vector integer divide instruction. If you want to do integer division, you can't use the vector registers. You need to move the value into a normal register and use the normal integer divide instruction one number at a time. And then if you want to move it back, and if the compiler sees that, it's probably just going to say, not worth using vector instructions for this loop where I have to do division. And there might be some other operations which are that way. And a thing about that compiler vectorization is that it's a little fickle. So for example, the absolute latest versions of GCC and Clang generate vector instructions for the top loop and not the bottom loop. I'll let you take a look at it because the difference is pretty subtle. And this is not because you can't make a good vectorized version of the bottom function. You can. There are ways of vectorizing it. Like notably, we're accessing contiguous groups of these, like this and this are, we're doing k equals 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. We can use vector registers to load all those together, to multiply all those at the same time. And that would give us a significant performance improvement. But the compilers have this sort of pattern recognition, and if your code doesn't conform to one of their patterns, you don't get vectorized. And rather subtle things can do that, unfortunately. Like maybe, you know, in a couple years, I won't be able to easily find examples like this, but this is the current state of things, that I compile with O3 and enabling the 256-bit vector instructions. I get it for the top code, not for the bottom code. So questions? Yes. Okay. And there's also been other weird oddities. For example, older versions of Clang, Clang 5, which I believe one version behind what's on the lab machines, and used to be what was on in previous semesters, would generate vector instructions for this and not for this just because I changed the indices from ints to longs. Yeah. That's now fixed, but that's the sort of thing that people are used to experiencing with compiler vectorizers, is that, you know, when they work, it's great. When they don't work, who knows what you have to change to make them work. So if we can't rely on the compiler, we could write the assembly by hand. And that's possible and really annoying. So there's a middle ground. There's something called intrinsic functions. So Intel has defined a set of functions for compilers to implement, which will compile directly to particular instructions. So basically, it's a function which represents the instruction. And the idea is that you don't need to deal with all the array indexing logic and all the loop stuff. You can just say, I want to use this instruction here, but the compiler should handle all the code around it, putting variables and registers and so on. So let's give an example of that. So this code looks really ugly because Intel has made some bad naming choices. So let's start going through these naming choices. So first, we have this type, underscore underscore m256i. This represents 256 bits of integers that we can put in one of those YMM registers. There are also related types for 256 bits of floats and 256 bits of doubles. And I have functions that act on these, which typically start with underscore mm256. That's just the convention Intel chose. You might ask, what does MM stand for? Multimedia Extensions, which was the first version of vector instructions Intel implemented back in the 90s. So it's just a bad old name that's not been changed. So we have these functions here that represent, in this case, this represents the vmove. So this is vmove dqu instruction that we saw earlier, which loads something from memory into a register. So this says there's a Canadian convention here where we have that prefix MM256, which says that this is a 256-bit vector function. And we have something at the end indicating the type of value it acts on. In this case, it says SI256, which means a 256-bit signed integer. That's the naming and load. Load is load for memory. The U stands for unaligned. So if you use load and not load U, the pointer address you supply must be a multiple of 32. And since we have an array of integers in this function, we can't guarantee that. So I use the unaligned version. So it's not going to complain about that. And there's also a corresponding store, which corresponds to the store. In both cases, this function expects a pointer to 256 bits of integers, so I have to cast from the array to that. And I'm sorry, this makes the code really ugly. So then we have the instruction for adding the integers, and this is what corresponds to our vp add d instruction we saw earlier. So here, we're taking a variable which represents one of the 256-bit vectors and another one, and we get the result in a new variable. That's another one of those vector registers, hopefully. So and this has the same naming convention, I should go over that, but we have EPI32 indicating that this acts on packed 32-bit integers is what the name comes from, extended packed 32-bit integers, it's 32-bit integers, however many fit in 256 bits. And as you might guess, there's a version of this for 64-bit integers where you replace the 32 with the 64 and so on. So any questions on this code here? So the question is, what happens if my computer doesn't have these instructions? Then this will not work. It also will not work if you don't pass the compiler the option to, say, generate these instructions, which is not the default because your compiler typically defaults to working on any 64-bit Intel processor, which means not making these instructions. Other questions? Okay. And as I mentioned, you can have a different size. So we can do the same thing here with, I did not change this completely from 200. So in previous semesters, we used 128 bits, and I didn't edit this slide enough. I edited it partly, enough so I thought I edited it completely. So you can do the same thing here, but with replacing 32-bit with 64. And I just have some lingering. So this means for 64-bit values, we'd increment by I plus equals 4 each time. We'd use the 256-bit values, add them together, and add 4 with the YMM registers. I will correct this slide when I upload it, though I think the changes are pretty mechanical,
fixes. So, but basically the idea is we have this 32-bit version. There's also a 64-bit version where we just load 256 bits of 64-bit values, so we have to change how much we increment the loop. And as I alluded to there, there's a 128-bit version of all of these, and sometimes it might be handy to use those if you have less than 256 bits of stuff. And they use this XMM instead of YMM registers, and the intrinsics work the same way, except you replace 256 with 128, except in the names of functions. The names of functions, you replace MM256 with MM128. Was it MM not 128, just MM, sorry. Even though you'd expect MM128, that's not what it is. Sorry, it's not consistent. Okay, so questions on intrinsics? Yeah.
Just on this slide, like for the bottom instruction, the load U, like the 256 becomes the 128.
Yes, and the and then yeah, so we still keep these extensions indicating the type.
So for the middle one, because didn't we say like the EPI?
So the EPI just so yeah, so the types for the loads and stores change from 256 to 128 because it's indicating the size of the whole thing. For the things like EPI 32, it just means as many 32-bit values as fit.
Okay.
So it doesn't change. And in general, I'm not expecting you to memorize these. There is a reference that Intel provides, there's a reference we will provide, and you can look things up. But I'm just giving the general idea so you won't be surprised that you can't guess the name. So as I hinted, we're going to have you use these intrinsics in assignments. In the smooth assignment, you almost certainly will not be able to achieve the required speed up without using intrinsics, but if you manage, that's great. In order to prevent you from having surprises with the compiler sometimes vectorizing things and sometimes not, we have set the optimization level such that vectorization won't happen. So you will submit a C file, and you will have to do the vectorization yourself with these intrinsics rather than doing that. There's two goals for this. So one is you understand what the compiler would do if it vectorized it. And two, like this is a skill that's actually useful when the compiler either can't figure out how to use the vector instructions or it figures it out, but it figures it out in a way which might not be the best way of using them. And that's common cases where in the real world, people will write intrinsic functions in their code because the compilers aren't doing a good enough job. Okay, so let's talk about optimizing a matrix multiply. I should have changed. That's another. Here. So we have a matrix multiply. We have C plus equals A times B. Simple matrix multiply, and we're going to vectorize it. And so we're going to unroll this here. So the first step for vectorizing is to have pairs of the appropriate number of things. In this case, I have unsigned ints. I can fit 8 of them. So I'm going to do pairs of 8 of them. And this should be probably named matmul. So I've just unrolled this loop in order to have 8 things, and this looks like what we want for our vector instructions. Note that we're taking a group of value of 8 values here and multiplying it times a group of 8 values, and then we're adding that to another group of 8 values. So that's what we're going to want to do with vector instructions. So we want this multiply for all the 8 operations to turn into one instruction. We want this plus equals for all the 8 operations to return into a vector add instruction and a vector store. So if this idea makes sense, sort of the high level structure I'm going to use. So my first step was I unrolled the loop I had in order to expose these groups of
the appropriate number of operations, 8 in this case, because we can fit 8 things in our 256-bit vectors. Questions? Okay, yeah.
What do you mean by A?
A and
B.
What do I mean by A and B?
No,
Noel. That's note bene, whatever, Latin for know well. Just noting that this is not optimized matrix multiply code, because if n is big, you want to do hash blocking in addition to this. Okay, so there's some handy intrinsic functions here, and one of them is that there's a function for loading multiple copies of a 32-bit value. So this is called set1. So this sets one value for all elements of the vector. So in this case, it's the 32-bit version, so it takes a single value and it's going to load it into all 8 slots of the 256-bit vector, that one 32-bit value. And this is really handy because it looks like we want to take this one value here and have 8 copies of it to multiply times our 8 values from B. So that's what we're going to use to get 8 copies of that value. So then we can use the multiply instruction, which is going to work on pairs. We don't have a multiply instruction which says multiply the first thing with every other thing. We only have one which does pairs. So that's going to let us arrange things for that multiply instruction to do what we want. And we also need a multiply instruction. And you would probably assume that based on you seeing add EPI 32, that it would be called mul EPI 32 or something like that. It's mul low is the one you want. It multiplies 8 pairs of 32-bit values and gives the lowest 32 bits of the result. There's also an intrinsic called mul EPI 32, which takes pairs and gives you the 64-bit results. But we only care about the bottom 32 bits of the result. We don't care about any overflow. So now we're going to vectorize this code. So the first thing I need to do, I'm going to write the code for loading and storing C. And note that conveniently, the way I structured this loop, because it had great spatial locality, it turns out that I'm loading elements of C which are right next to each other. So I can just load 256 bits of values from C, and it's going to be J plus 0, J plus 1, J plus 2, and so on. They're all together in memory. If that wasn't the case, this would be a lot more annoying, and I need to do something a lot more complicated. So something we'll often do when we want to use vector instructions or want our compiler to use vector instructions is try to expose this spatial locality so we can actually load something into a vector conveniently. Otherwise, we'd have to rearrange it in memory or rearrange it in vectors. There are instructions for doing that, but they aren't that efficient, and they're not easy to figure out how to use. So this is our preference, is that they're already in the order we want them in the vector, in memory. We just load it all. So we have our load and our store. Okay. And oh, someone forgot to change a variable name. That should be CI. So we load it into a variable and we store it in a variable. And this variable is going to be one of the M256i of CIJ, and this holds not C of I and J, but C of IJ plus 0, 1, 2 to 7. That's our one variable, which represents 8 values from C. And so I'm going to load it, store it, and in the middle, I have to somehow add the value we want to it. So next thing is to figure out how to do that. And I'm going to start by figuring out how to load from B. Same way as we're doing for C, it's just from a different starting location. I guess also I've omitted the cast here, but we would need it in practice, just to keep the slide simpler. And I also need to load from A. And for that, remember I talked about this set one function, so I'm going to use a normal way of addressing that element of A and use the set one intrinsic to turn it in from a 32-bit value to 8 copies of that value in a vector. And once I have that, I can multiply them together, and it's exactly the multiplication we want to do. And I get my result. Does this make sense? And I'm sorry for mixing up A and B here. Okay, so I have my result, and I just, what's the next step here? I have the result of the multiplication. What do I want to do with it?
Store it into C,
almost. That's. I want to add it to C first. I want to add it to the values in C, do the plus equals, and then store it into C. Store that result of that into C. So I'm going to add, right, that's what I forgot about, into C and not B. This is what I get for changing slides from last semester. I promise I will fix this when I post it. And that's what we put all together to get our final result. So does this idea, this makes sense? So have, if I just correct the Cij and C here, I think I, how did I not notice that? I corrected the bottom, but not the top of this line. But the code here, I believe, is actually correct. The comments might not be. The code is the vector instructions generally. So we load. We load 8 elements from C. So this should be Cij. Cij plus 1, Cij plus 2, up to Cij plus 7. And we load elements from B, and we load the one element from A, which we duplicate into the vector. Then we multiply the pairs of values of A and B, and then we add that to C. And then we still have C in a register, so we need to write that back to our vector, to our actual array, rather, from the vector register. Make sense? Okay, so we'll have a lab on this, as I said, which will be much more concrete and have less typos after the Thanksgiving break. Since we won't have lab next Wednesday, since we're not supposed to do that. Okay, so some other minor notes on vector instructions. So sometimes you'll have values which aren't in the right place in a vector. And this is tricky. There are ways of doing it. So there are instructions and therefore intrinsics for dealing with this, which has various names that are not obvious names that you would guess. It's sometimes called shuffling, swizzling, permuting. And you might need some combination of them. And usually you can rearrange values the way you want with some use of these. In the worst case, you can put values on the stack, rearrange them on the stack with normal instructions, then put them back in vectors. So that's obviously pretty slow. So an example of this is if I want to do this rearranging, I get 1, 2, 3, 4 in a vector as 16-bit numbers. And then there's this permute 4x64 intrinsic, which rearranges the values according to the indexes I want. So it makes index 2 be the first output value. So this is 0, 1, 2, 3. So index 2 becomes the first output value, which is why I have a 3 at the beginning of the result. Then index 3, which is why I have a 4 at the in the next part of the result. And then index 0, which is why I have a 1 here. Then index 1, which is why I have a 2 here. And I encode that as a special integer, which is the way using the intrinsic has this horrible interface is because this is how the instruction that this is using works. The instruction takes a constant, which is how to rearrange things, and that's the constant it takes. So I don't expect you to memorize how to use this, but you can look up what the encoding is. And this is why I said it's really annoying if things aren't already in the right order. And another little note is that some of that Intel, when they added the 256-bit instructions, these were designed with the 128-bit ones in mind. In particular, they had a design goal that it's possible to implement using 128-bit ALUs, where you just split the vector into two pieces and you do two operations instead of one. And this means that there are instructions which you would expect to do things on both halves of a value, which in fact don't do that. So this might explain some weirdness you'll see. So for example, there are instructions which take two vectors and interleave the values from them. And you'd expect that to work across put values from the top half of one vector and the bottom half of the results based on the pattern it has, and it won't do that because they wanted to make it possible to implement in this pattern. That's just mentioning this because when you actually try to use these, you might come across documentation where you're like, why did they do this? And it's because of this implementation technique. So another consequence of this sort of idea that they wanted to implement these 256-bit vectors with 128-bit components is that they actually shut down the high 128 bits of the ALUs when they're not in use to save power, which is great. You can save power. They also adjust clock speeds based on how much heat the processor is producing, because you can run at a higher clock speed as long as you aren't overheating. This means that some Intel processors will run at slower speeds when you're using the 256-bit vectors. It's still beneficial as long as you're using the vectors a lot, right? Because you're still doing twice as much computation at a slightly slower clock speed. That's still a lot better. But if you aren't using them a lot, this actually can hurt performance. And a final note, that there are other ways of writing vector instructions. So for example, GCC has some vector instructions extensions that are designed to be not specific to a particular instruction set. And they look kind of more like normal C code, but they work on vectors. There's also programming languages for things like GPUs, which are basically machines with lots of vector instructions, which look more like multi-threaded code, but it actually turns into vectorized code with vector instructions. And a brief note on other features of vector instructions. I guess AVX is pretty limiting. Again, changing from last semester, AVX is still pretty limiting. So there are other vector instructions which have more featureful extensions. Some of this is in AVX. Some in AVX 512, the 512-bit extension to this, partially in AVX, the version of AVX we'll be using. But there's other things that vector instructions can do to handle some problems you might, if you think about how do I vectorize code, is really hard. So one example is conditional handling. If my loop does different things for each element, it seems really hard to use vector instructions. There are things we can do to make that more possible. There are ways of having variable length vectors with hardware support, which helps you deal with the end of the loop. Right now, I didn't show any vectorized code dealing with what if it's not a multiple of 8, but in practice, you need to deal with that, and you need to have like code for the leftover that doesn't use vectors. And also for loading and storing non-contiguous values. So there's code, sometimes some processors have instructions that make it easier to do that rather than requiring you to rearrange things yourself in order to do that. Okay, so any questions on vector instructions? Okay, and I apologize for having typos on slides that I should have realized. I'll correct it when I post it later today. So a final topic on optimization is mentioning that you want to spend time where it matters. So in a program, if you spend 90% of your time reading files, well, you shouldn't spend your time adding vector intrinsics to your code because congratulations, you're making 10% of your program really fast. And your program will now be like 5% faster. You should optimize your file reading. So your first step, if you have a real program to optimize and not just like make this function fast, it should be a tool called a profiler. And the profiler is a tool which will tell you where does my code spend its time. And there's lots of tools. I'll give you an example of the one of the profilers on Linux, which is called perf, P-E-R-F. And the way perf works is that it's a sampling profiler. So what it does is you run a program with the profiler, and periodically it stops your program, looks at what instruction it was running, and records that. And then later on, you can look at what instructions was running each time it stopped. And the idea is if you run the program often enough and you're like recording like 200 or 500 times a second, and you run it for like a minute, you'll get pretty good idea about where your program is spending its time. And to give a really concrete example, so let's say I decide that HTLRS is slow. Or let me pull up my. So what I can do is I can say, let's profile it. So I'm going to record, and I have some options here. So the F500 means sample 500 times a second, and the call graph equals LBR means I want you to record not just what code was running, but what function called that code which was running. And I'm going to run a version of HTRS which has debugging information so I can figure out what functions these are in, which the stock version doesn't to save disk space. And I'm going to run some program that takes a while to run. So this is just running HTRS. And we see that HTLRS ran normally, and I also got this information about, I recorded 7,422 samples. And we can look at them with the report tool of this perf command. I'm going to pass no children. I'll talk about what that means in a second. And read this data file I just wrote. And you can see here, we're going to do this with a different version of perf, which knows how to demingle things. So we can see here that I have It tells me that I'm spending 37% of my time. When it stopped my program, I was in this function called evaluate in spanned expression in my code. So that tells me where in my code I was spending my time. And 18% of the time, it was stopped in my language's HashMap implementation. And 14 in a different part of my language's HashMap implementation. And 10% of the time in this run function. So this gives me an idea of where I should spend my time optimizing. So for example, one of the conclusions you might get from this is that, oh, maybe I should think of something that might be better than a hash map for what I'm using a hash map for, or way of optimizing that. That could maybe give me, you know, if I can make it twice as fast, I'll improve my performance by 20%. And I should also definitely look at what this function is doing and see if I can make that faster. This tool also lets you drill down into exactly where things happen. So I can look at the assembly, and annotated next on the left side is the percentage of time that that instruction was with the one that was stopped at. And this is interleaved with the, so this is the raw assembly. By default, it's interleaved with the with markers of where the code is from. So here, that's a piece of my line of my code. This is Rust code, which is why it doesn't look like C. So this is a listing of where my program was stopped when I was profiling. But I have this program was stopped in the hash map, and I don't know where the hash map is being used. And that's probably giving me a bad idea of where my time is being spent, because maybe the function that uses the hash map is really what I should be optimizing. So by default, if I don't pass this no children option, my profiler gives me information about where I have children and self. So children means I was stopped and I was either in this function or in something this function called. So start, which is the program function which calls main, accounts for most of the time, because of course when I was profiling, most of the time I was in something that main called, that start called, which was in something that main called, so that makes sense. But this is more useful because now it tells me that this spanned expression evaluate is not responsible for 37% of my time, it's responsible for 61% of my time, because usually when I stopped, I was in it or I was in something it was calling, like the hash map code. So questions about profiler here? Yeah.
Does it have memory profiling as well?
So does this have memory profiling as well? I don't. There might be. What do you mean by memory profiling?
Looking at like objects on the heap, amount of memory being used.
Okay. So memory profiling in the sense of the amount of memory being used, I don't think Perf is good at that. Perf is a tool where you could do things like figure out cache misses, though. Like, it does have features for that. Okay. So that's a profiler. There's other profilers for other OSs. I'm just showing you what they look like, because if you're optimizing real programs, that's where you should start. Don't be the person who spends time optimizing the computation of a program which is spending all its time reading files. I guess I'll give a brief note on one miscellaneous issue that sometimes comes up in the performance assignments. So we saw about eliminating repeated multiplications, so like eliminating this I times n, this k times n. And Daniel Graham mentioned that this is common sub-expression that we can take out of this loop, and the compiler could try to do that for us, and in fact, it will. So the compiler will commonly transform code like this to do something where we take the code out of the loop. And again, I have the C and C. To take the manipulation out of the loop rather than adding to
adding n each time, we'll just add n to the pointer rather than multiplying by n each time. So the compiler does this transformation where instead of multiplying by n of an increasing value, we add to n, and this is strength reduction, which Daniel Graham mentioned. And this is great. So it's turning I times n into plus plus I into keeping track of I times n and adding n to I times n. So this makes sense, this idea, this transformation? People look confused. I think I skipped over it. Go ahead. Yeah. Yeah, so basically mostly because this sort of thing is a common pattern, right? Where we're multiplying by an increasing value, it wants to transform that into just doing repeated additions. And in fact, usually the way it does it is by keep a pointer, a float star bkj, and do bkj plus equals n. It's usually how it does it. So it usually transforms it into a pointer operation, which means that the load is easier and runs faster. So that's great. It's optimizing our code. And a problem with this is that it does this a lot. So that's great too. Like, it will do this for multiple values. So we'll compute, we have all these AIs. It will just compute all of them at the beginning, and then it will increment each of the AI and will add the index to each of them. That's also great. Okay, so this makes sense. So we're just computing our bases and we're adding I times n to them in the loop. It's a great transformation. So seems fine. Now let's do it here. And this seems a little less fine because I have 20 AI bases I want to keep. That's going to run out of registers. And I'm going to have to keep them on the stack. Okay, so that's a problem if we have to do that. And unfortunately, I found that sometimes people will write code where the compiler will do this, where the compiler will do this transformation for you and helpfully keep values on the stack to compute addresses faster. And that might not end up actually being faster. So usually it will just do the right thing. Sometimes it might not. In that case, you can write the address transformation yourself and do something more explicit. So for example, if doing this doesn't make sense, keeping all these pointers to parses of A, you can instead just get a pointer to the base and add n as you go along. And the compiler might not do the most clever way of computing the addresses. You can do it if you want to. And that might make things faster. I wouldn't try it until you're worried that the compiler is doing the wrong thing, because usually what the compiler does is great. It's, as we saw with the small loops, it's really good. But you might be able to do better. So that makes sense. Okay, so let's talk about a completely different topic, which is not optimization then, unless there are more questions on optimization before I move on. Okay, so here I have a loop. So here's a program. If I run this on a department machine that's shared, can you still use that machine? Who thinks yes? Who thinks no? Okay, how about if that machine has exactly one core? Who thinks yes? Who thinks no? Okay, some people think no. So the answer, if you tried this experimentally, turns out to be yes, though people might yell at you for making their program slow, but you could still use it. And if we think about the assembly for this, it's just a loop. There's no instruction which actually says, let other people run their programs. So some other mechanism must be doing that. And we could, in fact, observe that. So here, I'm doing the same thing, but instead I'm timing things. I'm just timing empty piece of code. I'm going to see how long that takes. So if I do this, if we were just running alone, we'd expect to see the exact same difference every single time. And if I actually show the timings, this is an example of what I get. So at the bottom is the sample number of my timing, and the scale is the result I got. Note that this is a log scale. So usually we're spending, you know, like 10, 20 nanoseconds between timer measurements, and sometimes we're spending milliseconds. So what was happening here? Any guesses as to what was probably happening? Yeah?
The operating system was getting other programs in turn.
Yeah, so other things were running. And this is why on the shared department machine, other people can still use it, because the operating system just says, well, okay, we're just gonna run someone else right now. That takes some time. And that's what happened. So this is called time multiplexing. So I was running my loop program, and I had my instruction, and it just happened that, as far as I'm concerned, I had the processor to myself, but it was a really weird processor, which occasionally has million cycle stalls. And in that million cycle stall, what actually happened is the processor switched to running something else and then switched back to me. Questions about so far? Okay. And what really happens to do this is that the operating system runs for a little bit of time. So somehow the processor decides to start running the operating system. And then the operating system is what's responsible for actually switching to another program. And the mechanism by which the processor runs the operating system is called an exception. And in this case, the exception happens even though there is nothing in my program to trigger it. My program's instructions all do things which aren't exceptional, except for running for a long time. But still, an exception happened, and the processor switched to the operating system, and the operating system switched to another program based on that. And we call when the operating system finishes handling an exception, returning from an exception. And one of the things it can do is it can arrange for when it returns, rather than returning to where the exception happened, it can return to somewhere else. And that's what it does when it decides to run another program. So the operating system made the choice, I want to return to ssh.exe because it deserves to run more than your infinite loop. Sorry. Okay. And so what the OS is doing is somehow it arranges to start running, and we'll talk about that mechanism later, and it's going to save the state of our program somewhere. So it needs to remember, where were we, what were our registers? So later on, when we start running again, it's as if nothing happened. All our registers are there, our program's running the next instruction just like it should, everything's normal. And then it needs to restore the registers that it previously saved for another program. So SSH was running, it stopped running, and at that point in time, it saved those registers for SSH, saved its program counter, and needs to arrange to jump to that saved program counter for SSH. And this whole process is called a context switch. The saved information that we're saving or restoring is called a context. So each process has a context, which, as far as we're concerned so far, is its program counter and its registers. Okay, so it's all the state, and also condition codes, all the state we need to run your program correctly, not the contents of memory. We assume memory stays the same. We just have pointers to it in our registers and our program counter. So this makes sense. So conceptually, what our context switch looks like is that we copy the PC from before the exception happened, which we need some help from our processor to do. In this case, I'm saying maybe there's a special instruction to do that. And then I save all the registers that we have in the program, and I restore the ones for the program I want to switch to and jump to where I'm supposed to jump to
where I saved previously for that program. And so how this turns out is that A was running, and we have the CPU pointing to A's memory, and the OS in its memory had a copy of B's registers and condition codes and program counter. Then an exception happens, and the OS switches to running B and swaps the registers it had saved from program A's to having program B's register saved. Now program B's registers are on the CPU, and also program A's registers are going to be stored in the OS's memory for later when the OS is going to switch back to it. Okay, so questions? Yes. Okay, so that's context switches. This is triggered by an exception, and it's how we switch between two programs. So something this picture is showing is it's like just conceptually all the memory is there. You can access it. You might know that that's not how things work. So what do you think happens if I have this code? So I have program A, I have a value at a fixed address, and I'm going to load it into a register. And program B, let's say I just try to write to that fixed address. So what's going to happen here? So first of all, what's the result in RAX in program A? Who has a guess as to what the possible results are? No one.
They run on different memory spaces.
Okay, so you say they're going to run on different memory spaces. So what does that mean the results in REX is going to be?
10,000 hex, whatever that is.
This is the address. Sorry. The value at the address is 42. So it's going to be always 42. In program B, well, it's writing to address 10,000, and it might crash. That crash is actually going to be a type of exception. Exception plus the OS crashes the program. So if it so what might happen here is because that's not the program's memory, if it's not the program's memory, it might try to access it. The processor will run the OS via this mechanism we set exceptions, and the OS might decide to crash the program, or it might write to some value, but it won't be the same one. Yeah, but regardless, it's not going to interfere with program A. And you mentioned that they have different memory spaces. So this is the typical layout of program memory on Linux, that we have our stack, we have our heap, we have our code and our globals, and we have some space at the top of memory used by the OS. If we have two programs, they have their own code, heap, and data, and they appear to have things at the same memory location, but that's not actually true. So program A has an address 0x1000. Program B might also have the same address. And if it does, well, it can write to that address, but it won't be writing to program A's memory. And maybe, or if 0x1000 is somewhere there, it tries to write it, it's going to fail. And the way this works is that we have a mapping in the processor set by the OS, which Daniel Graham's going to talk about as our last topic in this class, which takes like at least three lectures, called virtual memory. Programs have the illusion that they have their own memory, and this is called an address space. And the way we provide this is by having the OS set a mapping for each program of how the address is mapped. And this is another thing we're going to change during our context switch. And I think that's where you'll pick up next time.